Welcome to the A-News Podcast. This is episode 23 for August 8th, 2017. This podcast covers anarchist activity, ideas, and conversations from the previous week. It's designed to be useful to anarchists and the anarcho-curious. Give us feedback and constructive criticism at our email address, podcast@anarchistnews.org. Most stories have more information at the non-sectarian anarchist news site, anarchistnews.org. Editorial: Capitalism and Anarchist Projects. Current example, IGD. The busiest and snarkiest story thread this week was the one about IGD and Patreon. While most of the conflict between IGD readers and A-News readers continues to be at least as much about style as anything else, what is funny, what does humor reflect, how does one express humor, and the benefits and detriments of being very serious, this story brings up the ongoing thorny issue of anarchists raising money in the name of anarchism. The conflict is obvious. We are anti-capitalist. We exist in a capitalist world. To survive requires negotiating this contradiction at every turn. To attempt to be big in the world, to do anarchist projects beyond small circles, means putting more and more muscle into turning wheels that we don't even want to exist. Every one of us negotiates this all the time, but the bigger the project tries to be, the more public the negotiation, and the more successful the project, the more contradictory it is. Success also means that more people, each with their own boundaries and gauges of what is acceptable, comes to bear. This tension is part of being an anarchist in this world. None of us need ever relax or forget about it. But let's take the IGD situation as a concrete example of this conundrum. The IGD post is attempting to rally forces to get a specific response from Patreon so that IGD can get what they are owed under capitalist rules. Obviously, on one metric, that's a valid effort, one that we all might do and probably have done under various circumstances of unfair treatment. On another metric, no one should expect capitalists or business owners to be fair. That's appropriate for anarchists to point out to each other. The demand for fairness is in conflict with an anarchist analysis. A practical possibility would be for IGD to have one request for the liberals in their audience and a different kind of appeal, perhaps appealing for a different thing, for the anarchists. There are probably other interesting options also. I will end with an excerpt that is mostly questions from an editorial from an old anarchy magazine about the issue of anarchist businesses and projects, about what makes them anarchist. Quote, "Some questions to consider for specific projects. Does anyone engaged in it expect to live off the profits? Does the project attempt to compete on a large stage, i.e. does it use the standard capitalist business model? How is the project open and transparent? How is it not? Does it encourage and support or shut down and compete with other anarchist projects? What else are the people in the project involved in? Does the project have a centralizing tendency, or is it part of networks? And if so, what kind of networks? Anarchists are engaged in juggling two incompatible concepts. One is a fundamental opposition to the world we live in, and the other is the need to actually live in, and we hope have an impact on, this world. We all have to find our own ways, with as much help and critical feedback as we can stand. Sometimes more." Unquote. As an aside, many of the stories on A-News in the past couple of weeks have had interesting and thoughtful commentary. Appreciative thanks to the commenters who keep this project lively, fun, and engaging.
Money, technicality, money, really actually, money on a gold plate, money, music all day, money in the studio, money takes all day, money, take my breath away, melody, oh baby, hey, money, technicality.
What's new this week? Gord Hill, Indigenous artist and anarchist, from Crime Think. Gord is probably the most accessible native voice for anarchists, as he has produced comic books with his distinctive and compelling art style and has been around anarchist circles for many years. This is an interview with him primarily as an artist, but also brings up intersections between Indigenous folks and anarchists, etc. The interview includes some full-color images by him, which are, of course, beautiful. Quote, "Being an artist and historian, can you talk about the differences between written history and oral tradition and how the use of imagery might interact with these methods?" Written history is useful for historians as it provides dates, names, and locations, which help in understanding history chronologically. From this chronology, we can see, for example, the process of colonization or the expansion of an empire, etc. European states didn't appear out of nowhere, but were the result of a long history of colonization by the Romans and centuries of warfare between feudal kingdoms that emerged after the collapse of the Roman Empire. This history, much of it recorded by observers at the time, helps us understand how the world we live in today was created. The oral history of indigenous peoples has been portrayed as mythologies or fantasy, but we know today that events that are told as oral history are actually real events that occurred. For example, there are widespread oral histories of an earthquake and tsunami dating from the 1700s along the Northwest coast. that scientists now know actually occurred and that caused considerable destruction to many villages. The oral history of this event portrays it as resulting from the actions of spiritual forces. Until scientists linked the stories to actual events, they were generally dismissed as mythology. In regards to oral history, indigenous people had many ways of portraying these histories through graphic arts, such as pictographs, paintings, beadwork, and carvings. Songs and dances were another way that these oral histories were remembered. Today, there are examples of oral history that continue to be used, including poetry and hip-hop. Even videos with interviews and testimonials are examples of oral history. I find that comics are a good middle ground in that they combine written history with graphic images. Unquote.
Audio interview. What made the G20 protests possible? If you haven't gotten enough information about the G20 events, or if you'd like to hear it instead of read it, this interview of a Black Rose Federation member who was at the G20 is an option.
Why do they publish so many communiques if they don't want to convince anyone, and other dumb questions? The ITASA person responds to some of the most repeated critic questions about eco-extremists. The most surprising to me was the open-ended response to, "Does ITS even do the things?" since the author examines the evidence with a skeptical eye. The tone of this piece is snarky, which is fair, since the people who ask the questions don't seem that interested in the answers.
325, the tough bitches. From antisocialevolution.altervista.com, this seems to be a response to one of the eco-extremist communiques, which called out 325 for not being all the way down or whatever. The language of this response is jumbled, or maybe it's the punctuation that is confusing, but a couple points seem to be that the writers of the communique are ideological and that they take too seriously what they see on corporate media. Those both seem like fair points. It's also unclear why 325 is in the title. Is this a member of 325 who is responding?
Meet the LGBT anarchists who've gone to Syria to fight ISIS. From The Independent, a UK source, this is a short, very sympathetic piece about Tequila, TQILA, a.k.a. the Queer Insurrection and Liberation Army, a new unit attached to the Anarchist International Revolutionary People's Guerrilla Forces. Quote, "Indeed, the fight for LGBT equality and for physical freedom from oppression reach a zenith in the fight against ISIS," a spokesperson said. "As queers from and currently in the Middle East, one of the most radical acts we can do is to announce our existence to people and governments who have and continue to claim that we do not exist. We exist and we fight against tyranny, oppression, and domination with the people who, seeing us, have come to love us for who we are and not as a stereotype or something to be feared." Unquote.
Where anarchy meets wholeness, a new vision of panarchy. A blogger positing the option of anarchy with governance, aka management.
Call for submissions, growing into anarchy. Magpie is looking for pieces on aging as an anarchist for a new zine anthology, especially for marginalized folks.
Who is behind the anti-gentrification violence in Saint-Henri? From mainstream media source CBC.ca comes a report on, quote, "quite organized attacks," unquote, that are, quote, "dividing the anarchist community," unquote. Quote, "No one has claimed responsibility for the attack, and police haven't explicitly linked to an anti-gentrification anarchists, but Montreal Police Commander Sylvain Parent said in it fits an established pattern. It occurred in Saint-Henri, and it involves an Audi and a BMW, which are usually cars associated with a certain luxury," he said. Unquote.
A short introduction to the politics of cruelty. From incivility.org, this post is the introduction from the first issue of the Hostas Journal. There are now two issues, and it explains the perspective of the journal. Attacked by 1A News Anonymous as promoting sociopathy, it explores how one actually moves beyond the Christian morality that anarchism comes from historically and that it continues to be steeped in. Quote, "Ethics, on the one hand, demands a unified, consistent, principled set of habits that constrains one's activities to what is good. This is why the politics of objection can be the most reactionary, as it simply parrots the world in relief. A life without ethical commitments, on the other hand, allows one to be free to do whatever. The immoralist's freedom does not come from the transgressive deviance not being as one is supposed to be, but the freedom of someone who has gotten rid of themselves and therefore becomes indifferent to any particular way at all. Only then is one free to take on multiple identities, free to advocate contradictory positions, and free to speak in as many voices as necessary. There are certainly risks involved, and we have nasty names for those who use this freedom poorly: opportunists, cheats, and traitors. What one does with such freedom, however, is not ethical, it is political, unquote. This article names the ethical and the prefigurative as the two main categories that Hostis is determined to move beyond. Quote, civil war is the alternative to the social. Against the social and socialism, we pit the common and communism. Our alternative institutions are war machines and not organs of a new society. The goal cannot be to form a clique or to build the milieu. Insurrectionary communism intensifies truly common conditions for revolt. It extends what is already being expropriated, amplifies frustrations shared by everyone, and communicates in a form recognized by all. We fight for sleep, for every minute in bed is a moment wrested from capital. We deepen the hostility, for anger is what keeps people burning hot with fury during the cold, protracted war waged by our faceless enemies. Unquote. There is a lot of provocation in this article.
Rethinking Violence Against Instrumentalism. From the site miko-ew.wordpress.com, quote, Reflections from the Interstices of Savagery and Civilization, unquote. The second article this week that troubles the connection of violence to ethics. It points out that part of why recent eco-extremist communiques are uncomfortable for Western minds is the challenge to causality that they represent. This article is sympathetic to the idea of people as potential forces of wildness. Much as mainstream anti-civ folks will cheer when the world happens against pieces of civilization, so do eco-extremists and their sympathizers cheer when people do so. Quote, But the eco-extremist position offered and continues to demonstrate a stark counterpoint against our more modern understandings of the place and role of violence and our conceptions of war. The eco-extremist war, unlike that of, say, the more instrumental and militaristic approach of Kaczynski-inspired eco-radicals, is the embodiment of a form of primal violence in a state of total war which mirrors the violence of nature itself. The eco-extremist form of war is a coherent continuation and enactment of their anti-modernism, anti-progressivism, anti-humanism, and the like. Its war spits on the hollow decrees of law and order, which are imposed even on the forms of violence which are seen as acceptable in the eyes of hyper-civilized. In place of the rules of engagement of men, it offers only the natural law, primal violence. Unquote.
A year of making noise. From conflictmn.blackblogs.org. This piece reflects on the organizing that happened in 2016 and hopes that people will do better. Quote, Above all, it seems that combative efforts have been poured into local anti-fascist organizing. The metropolitan area has seen at least four significant clashes between patriots of one sort or another and anti-fascists in as many months. With each action, there appears to be a downward trend in terms of the anti-fascists' offensive capacity. Each action sees the right closer and closer to a decisive victory. This statement is no doubt controversial, yet it is not the purpose of this essay to examine in depth the clashes of the past several months. Rather, we intend to examine what we thought were some of the recent peaks of collective autonomous action, in hopes that it can inspire those who feel as dissatisfied with the current trajectory of things as we do. Unquote.
Caught in the net. This is the editorial from Return Fire Number 4, a UK publication announced last week, and it revisits a topic on many people's minds these days, the effect of screens. It echoes and greatly expands on the point made in last week's podcast about the revolution of tech that we are living through. It explicitly addresses the changes in reading, which was particularly interesting to me, but also the issues of digital dementia, internet addiction, neural changes, and the simplification of thinking that seems to characterize people raised with today's screens. Quote, Never before has such a hoard of data existed on so widely accessible platforms concerning the aspects of the world today we might consider to be horrors. Rapes, climate-induced flooding, hostage beheadings, industrial disasters, and police violence come tumbling out of our news feeds and video tubes, circumventing censorship and state borders. And yet never has so little been done relative to the immensity of the dangers we face. On the one hand, some positively see the potential for this visibility to spark revolts against whatever atrocity in question, rebellions of the type that have not been lacking throughout pre-digital history, if yet to be decisive. On the other hand, others see the mere existence of this democratization of information as a counterbalance to the excesses of our rulers. Both seem to rest on an assumption which we ourselves do not find to be true, namely, that there is a simple causal relationship between information and action. However, another angle to take would be that uprisings continue to exist despite the prevalence of digital media, including their protagonists' own use of it, not because of it, and that the feast of information famishes our appetite to weaponize and make use of it to make it our own, unquote. This is well worth reading. It pulls together many thoughtful voices and perspectives on this moment that has a lot to teach us about how revolutions actually work.
Taking rewilding seriously. From the Dark Mountain Project, a non-anarchist but intriguing site and publisher in the UK, this is the latest from John Jacoby. It considers rewilding as a fad and distinguishes between real and less authentic efforts to decouple from civilization. It's nice that it doesn't cite Indians in the abstract as iconic nature experts, and that it doesn't overly reference himself, as he has been prone to in previous articles. Quote, rewilding has become something of a fad. The internet and libraries are chock full of instruction manuals for using primitive medicine, making primitive tools, adopting primitive religious thought. Often attached are calls to, quote, awaken our inner primal spirit. This seems like rewilding, right? Wrong. Rewilding, when applied to human beings, cannot only be about lifestyle changes. Of course, you can't live in nature if you don't know how to build a shelter or identify plants. You can't immerse yourself in the wild without basic navigation skills. But the rewilding fad has got it mostly wrong. It isn't about selling a way to become independent of civilization. It is about selling an aesthetic, an appearance of authenticity, much like Whole Foods stores are designed to look like local farmers markets, unquote.
Hashtag DefendJ20 Solidarity Actions. From defendj20resistance.org, this is simply a list, a long list, of the actions to inform or remind people about the situation of the J20 defendants.
ITS, or the Rhetoric of Decay, Joint Statement of Insurrectional Groups in Mexican Territory, from 325. A response from members and ex-members of various Mexican groups to ITS et al. This post points out that these are folks who were originally supportive of eco-extremism, both in theory and in practice, but that the eco-mafia has become authoritarian and anti-anarchist. However, the authors also take aim at, quote, the cowardly rumors and scurrilous murmurings of anarcho-legalists, anarcho-federists, anarcho-zapaterics, anarcho-pacifists, and other tribes tending to pose in immobility in fictitious organizations and the gradual evolution of the species, unquote, and reject the conflation of insurrectionary and individualist tendencies with the actions of the eco-mafia. Quote, on the alleged decline of the informal anarchist tendency and the supposed disappearance of the affinity groups, it is enough to take a look at the portals of anarchist diffusion to corroborate the emergence throughout the Mexican region of a new generation of informal groupings that have joined the anarchic action, giving continuity and long life to the trend. Just to mention a couple of examples, it is worth highlighting the anti-systemic conflict of the comrades of the informal feminist command of anti-authoritarian action and the autonomous group of sabotage Salvador Almos Garcia. Undoubtedly, we will have much to think about methodology and the aim of anarchic war. We will have to exchange ideas and practices and enrich the praxis by directing our steps toward the consolidation of a new anarchic paradigm that responds to the peculiarities of the war against domination in the 21st century. And, of course, we are likely to have new discussions, interpersonal disputes, and even fights. But we are sure that these apparent setbacks will widen the path and strengthen the indomitable refractory struggle. As Comrade Gustavo reminds us, anarchism, conceived not as an inescapable realization, but as a permanent tension embodied in an open configuration of thought and action, is also a tiger, indomitable and fierce, affected from end to end by its capricious walk into freedom. Let nothing escape our sure claw. Unquote.
Media. Our new books are available, No Wall They Can Build and From Democracy to Freedom. CrimeThink has been fundraising for these books, and they're available now for orders. Predictably, the only comment about them on A-News is a positive one.
Trouble 5. You are being watched. 35 minutes long. From Submedia TV, Trouble Number 5 represents many first-person accounts about informants. This kind of thing, information sharing about how infiltration actually works, including using identity to provide an easy response to any criticism, you must be a racist if you're questioning my behavior, etc. Each set of stories is really good and emphasizes a different important point. The Brandon Darby section points out that while Darby was dysfunctional and clearly working out issues, so were many people, and that that is usually going to be the case. It also discusses how capitalism is outstripping government surveillance. This is invaluable information and should be widely listened to and added to. That is, more people should talk about their experiences with informants and different kinds of infiltrators. Also, sadly, beware the reliable people who want to take notes. Except for me. Ha ha ha.
Editorial, Avalanche number 11, July 2017. Avalanche is a publication in multiple languages. It is a space for anarchist correspondence. Quote, in contradiction to a perspective which is only driven by the hunger for new followers for the own identity, our projects, so the diverse and different projects of the several individuals sharing this project, are aiming at something different. The attempt to launch and develop insurrectionary dynamics and relations is an attempt to break up the isolation of our ideas and methods within the conflict against power, to experiment with the possibilities for a generalized rupture with the social reality surrounding us. Because being only a few comrades doesn't mean to be isolated. As well as the quality and the uncompromising way of a stance within a conflict can also be something shareable. Because our relations and struggles are not dependent on the sharing of a fixed identity, of a name or a formal physical structure, but rather on the way how we want to fight against power. Which means that in our struggles, we are not only leaving bonds to formalities behind us to base our relationships on real affinities and experiences, but also that we are putting our struggles on an anti-political basis. Because for a method to potentially spread, it must be grounded upon the analysis of specific social conflictualities on the reality of conflict with power. Unquote.
Latin American anarchism, the reemergence of a viable current. This is Black Rose Federation's announcement of an upcoming book called Latin American Anarchism, and the ANews post is an excerpt from the introduction. Quote, this book follows on the heels of other publications by AK Press, including the English-translated editions of Horizontalism that was edited by Marina Citrin, Oscar Bayer's classic Rebellion in Patagonia, Juan Suriano's Paradoxes of Utopia, among other publications. However, anarchist history and theory produced in Latin America, past and present, is extremely vast and difficult to detail. It should be noted that Capoletti's book marks the beginning of a re-engagement with libertarianism after decades of being overshadowed by Marxism. The 90s anarchist revival went beyond the social movement arena as more people sought to revisit their anarchist predecessors, once deemed ultra-leftists or proto-communists, engendering new research by academics and worker intellectuals alike. Unquote.
Podcasts. TFS Radio, Margaret Killjoy on The Lamb Will Slaughter, The Lion. An hour and 10 minutes long. Only one podcast this week. In this episode of The Final Straw, William interviews Margaret and Magpie Killjoy on their about-to-be-released anarchist utopic novella. Sean starts at about 5 minutes in, and this time talks about rat experiments that demonstrated that utopias are more complicated than one might assume. Meaningful social rules might be far more significant than crowding, etc. There is music over Sean for part of this, and it's badly chosen and makes him hard to hear. In the interview starts at 12 minutes. One interesting question involved writing for and from a subculture. Margaret posits that the mainstream is very ready for anarchist ideas at the moment. Also raised is the significance of critiques of statelessness in good anarchist fiction. The question of representation by others is discussed, but not the question of representation, period. If representation is as much or more co-optable, then does it matter if it's accurate representation?
Topic of the week, chasing politics. The ups and downs of mainstream politics are generally a clusterfuck, to say the least. How do we respond expediently when things are so unpredictable? What does the slippery nature of the public's relationship with and reaction to politics mean to us anarchists? Is there anything destabilizing about the constant political upheaval that you've found to be beneficial or detrimental to what you do as an anarchist? What causes a project that began as a response to a mainstream political moment to materialize into something that lasts beyond that fleeting moment in politics? How do you keep the notion of anti-politics in mind when such big waves keep splashing through mainstream politics? When do these shifts in mainstream politics influence your everyday life, beyond the chatter? And when and why has it been important to either respond or reposition yourself as an anarchist?
Well, I think that the times when I've respected anarchist responses to mainstream political events has been in the context of anti-war protests. You know, anarchists have always been very clear about their anti-war attitude, and, you know, the 2003 anti-war stuff was pretty inspiring. I mean, we were lucky enough to be in the Bay Area, but I think most of the country had a surprising turnout of people, and it felt like we were doing something, whatever that means.
This question makes me itchy, twitchy. I don't know. I was really impressed by the Bay Area anarchists and their involvement in Occupy.
Mm-hmm.
I was not here. I was in New York at the time. And while anarchists in New York were involved in Occupy,
arguably the core of it,
they were overshadowed by the large numbers of liberals with money and celebrities and superstars taking podiums. And so it looked really different here.
We had our share of that.
Sure. And I found that myself watching that fairly closely at the time.
But it's hard to know. Occupy was a synthetic event. It wasn't to some extent, it seems like this topic of the week is referring to Trump and to the sort of shit show that's been around the Trump administration. And, you know, the only anarchist response to that is to sort of regalvanize itself around anti-fascist politics, which doesn't seem like a response to Trump. It seems like a response to the times or a response to something that isn't as timely as
sure.
the politicalness of Trump and the Trump administration. That's why I brought up the anti-war thing. But I'm not sure, you know, I mean, when I was younger, I was not so critical of activism and of the instinct to do something. You know, I tried to think about it more in the context of, like, what is there to be done and what strategic movement is there? But anarchism has no troops on the field, and it has almost no money. All it has is the enthusiasm of anarchists, which isn't nothing.
No.
And actually, I mean, one of the great things about Occupy, just to talk about that a little bit, was that non-anarchists or people who were maybe more, I don't want to say Machiavellian because that has such a negative connotation, but at the time, some people were calling themselves Sorellian. But there were some people who were anarchist adjacent. And they were the ones who sort of had the vision to organize around Occupy. They were the same people who organized in years past around Oscar Grant. And then they did some things around the library. And they were the ones that held together this book block. And so these people, they're not exactly anarchists, but they're not exactly not anarchists.
Yeah.
Like, in other words, they represent sort of the a more or less, like, at the end, we can call many of them, like, insurrectionary communists. So they really liked some of the ideas and some of the spirit of insurrectionary anarchism, but they were not themselves anarchists and had more affinity for more bookish sort of material. And so it's hard to, you know, I just don't want to conflate them and confuse the issues, because I think it is important to hold strong to the fact that, like, I might want to work with somebody or I might agree with what it is that they did in Occupy, even though it would seemingly contradict my critical activist attitude.
Mm-hmm.
But those people did do a good job of leveraging the anarchists around them and their enthusiasm.
Right. Sure.
And now we get into a messy territory.
Absolutely.
Because perhaps the answer to this question is that the best thing to do with anarchists is to unleash them in the world in a direction that they wouldn't necessarily be willing to unleash themselves in. And so then So then you're basically participating in a game of politics that I don't necessarily feel comfortable with. And, of course, just playing crazy what-if scenarios.
Yeah. Well, because when this happens, when it comes down to it, whatever cause and effect is created is generally, inevitably, someone else's politics, for better or worse. But I actually think that there's a premise in the question that should be challenged. And while you saw the question as being about Trump, I saw the question about being just kind of the general wave of, you know, there's always the hot topic of the week with politics and the mainstream media. Sure. And the way that people engage with politics. And so I think more than ever, politics is way more what we would have called water cooler focused back in the day. You know, what is trending? What
trans,
are the hot Twitter topics?
Trans in the military.
Yeah, hot. And, you know, it's very, very, very populist focused, very popular media focused, very. And I actually am going to say that I don't think that that's something that anarchists should engage with. Or more importantly, I don't think it's where we should start defining or tweaking our politics. Because frequently, whatever it is in the moment isn't really about the issue that it's about and doesn't actually have anything to do with, you know, whatever, the four big lines in the sand that anarchists are going to hold. But because it is topical and because it is the new hotness and because social media is what it is, I think that we are lured by its shininess and go there and either try to hold the anarchist line, which I think is fruitless, or end up making compromises to have the discussion, which maybe not be a bad thing, but then I worry about where those compromises lead us.
So you think that this conversation or this topic of the week is about chasing politics rather than, like, what do you think is a good idea for anarchists to spend their time doing now if they want to be engaged in outside the milieu?
I read the New York Times. I read the Washington Post. I read Al Jazeera. I pay attention to these things. And I think about, what does this mean for us? What does this mean for anarchists? What does this mean for...
like, what does it mean for John Kelly to rise to the chief of staff of the White House?
Maybe not quite so macro, but somewhere in there is woven some fairy tale or story or about the president and his relationship to it and another example of his whatever kind of behavior. And it's usually for me, because I'm so cynical. I'm a kind of worst case scenario person. I usually weave that back into what does this mean for when they come for us? But I guess I don't think that we should live in caves. I think that we should pay attention, and the people who we're playing on somebody else's field. So I think that we should know what the statists and the capitalists are talking about and what's important to them and how they're framing all of these things that we're trying to be in dialogue about. But I guess I think it's more about education than it is about a course of action. You look thoughtful.
Well, I have no idea what to say in response to that, because I don't want to... I guess my usual response would be to say, so you think the anarchists should educate themselves?
With the smarmiest face you can put on to say it.
It is my character flaw.
I am going to say that... when I was a younger anarchist, I was I came in contact with a lot of people who had their political line, but didn't actually have any real information about how those politics played out in the real world. They just had opinions. Yeah.
That's worse now than ever.
Maybe, sure. And I always thought that was dangerous. And if we, you know, we can be anti-capitalist, but if we don't actually understand what the capitalist means, when capitalists themselves mean when they talk about capitalism, that's bad for us. So you can turn that into something smarmy if you like.
I just was listening to an interview with a guy named Josh Burnett, who is a D-list celebrity who's well known for being the first heavyweight champion of the UFC. or one of the first, maybe the second. Anyways, he's what's called a shoot wrestler. And he was waxing poetic on his opinions about Marxism. And what was fascinating was that, on the one hand, his definition of Marxism was very high school level, a bunch of people who just think that we should all share and who hate the idea of one person having more than another.
Okay.
On the other hand, he actually knew what the Frankfurt School was, and that nowadays Marxists, by and large, aren't materialists or even particularly structural, and instead are mostly focused on cultural issues. So it was a fascinating...
That's an odd mix.
But it does...
There's something he read and something he missed?
Well, there's a bunch of things he missed, but he got some things, too.
Yeah.
That's the strange part. Because I'm not sure I disagree with that analysis, that what are called social justice warriors tend to be cultural Marxists.
Sure.
Along the lines that began with the Frankfurt School.
Right.
But I bring that up because it's echoing what it is that you're saying, which is that, by and large, when people argue with each other, when people talk about things, it doesn't seem like facts are what they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
They're doing something else, and mm-hmm. that something else is strange. I'm not exactly sure what to call it, but it's like factoid-based or something.
Sure.
But
which I don't think is behavior unique to anarchists in any way, shape, or form.
No, right. Well, actually, I mean, I guess the question for you would be, what would be your vision then? Like, okay, so anarchists are quote-unquote educated, then what?
That's a good question. I don't know. I don't have an answer for that. That's something that I would have to think about. That requires a kind of a linear progression type of analysis that I've never done.
Well, if this topic of the week is called Chasing Politics and definitely doesn't have anything that sounds like we shouldn't be chasing politics, we should be chasing tail.
My God, yes, he did just say that.
We should be chasing education? We should be chasing informing ourselves about the condition of the world and our place in it?
Yes, as one of a laundry list of things that we should be doing.
And the other ones are unnamed, or they're secrets? What level in the pyramid do I have to get to find out about these secrets?
I doubt you that, I have to kill you. I guess this is also... Let me start this over. The position that I am taking is probably much more a byproduct of my desire for anarchists in general to be having better discussions with each other than they are. And I think I might be stuck there a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm not sure what happens once anarchists actually start having better discussions with each other.
Sure.
And
it does seem like the likelihood of us having good discussions, if that's the goal, is less than if the goal for anarchists should be the next step beyond that, and having good conversations is the necessary step along the way.
I think I understood that strange sentence, and yes. So maybe I just don't have any faith, and I don't think we'll ever get to a point where we've raised the level of debate en masse, and so I haven't thought past that, but it's a thought exercise I should work through.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for that. Thanks. Coach yourself, coach yourself, fuck yourself, fuck yourself. Useless information occupies free open space inside your skull. You know what's going on every day, every night, everywhere it's really slow international. Upside down crossing a jumbotron, wait up, hold on. Blowing that threat off my palm, say what? You're wrong. Switch stance, face plan, napalm fire starter. Flatland, a plug puller, those dive turbulence charter. The Weekly Anarchy 101 Question and Some Answers. In this segment, we take questions and some of the answers and responses from the website anarchy101.org. This is a user-moderated Q&A site for anarchists to answer questions on anarchist thought and activity. Most questions on the site have a lot of commentary that we don't read, but that is certainly half the fun. The question this week is, what do anarchists think of the word revolution? Answer number one. I think that historically, and possibly to a lesser extent currently, the word and concept of revolution is significant for a good number of anarchists, though not always in support, for sure.
I personally have very little interest in either the word or the concept these days. I guess there was a time when a revolution of the mind was somewhat interesting to me, but as I got in touch with my own anarchistic tendencies, I came to see the whole idea as hugely coercive, highly politicized, and dependent on a mass movement requiring a level of unity I could never see as realistic, much less desirable. I could definitely see revolution as spookish, and I've known some folks I'd probably pin that on. Next answer. I think an insurrection is something that a history book would mention only to note that so-and-so put it down, which meant that he shot everyone and that he shot all their friends. Isn't this almost definitional, that something called an insurrection after the fact is therefore something that ended in mass executions? Most of my ancestors on one side were West Point men who became generals, and some of them made their career of putting down an insurrection in this or that U.S. colony. I think about that a lot. I think about the way these insurrections ended, and I think about how their work didn't. What would it mean on purpose to call something an insurrection? I suppose that you don't know what it would be like were it to succeed, even that you don't expect it to at all. I like that. I like and don't like that about the word. On the other hand, I think a revolution is over, which is a way of saying that instead of being ended by men with guns, it chose to end itself. To me, that's significant, but not in any way that I could simply affirm as being good. I am affirming insurrection instead of revolution as the word that I would like to think about, but only in a provisional way. There's not yet a word for the situation where people neither have their attempt ended for them, nor choose to end it themselves, since I don't think this has ever happened, and it's unclear what it would be like. Insurrection is a word for those attempts that understand this. Attempts, I mean, where people do not intend to end it themselves, and also do not pretend to know what it would be like, or how it would feel, or what they would do if no one were to stop them. It means acknowledging that their success would only bring more and worse problems, ones so far unthought of by them. Next answer. Others have answered to the spookiness of the revolution, but from an etymological reading and seeing the spook bear its fruit each time, I'd like to cease repeating, rolling back, and returning to the same shitty piece of world theater, only to see the tired role of revolutionary, believer in the wheel, acted by rote yet again. As always, if you don't like these answers or have questions of your own, visit anarchy101.org and join the conversation. This podcast is the effort of many people. This week, the podcast was sound edited by Lynn O'Mabel, written by Jackie, editorial written by Chisel, produced and narrated by Chisel and a friend. Thanks to Aragorn and Ariel for their help with the topic of the week. Contact us at podcast@anarchistnews.org. To learn more, books, pamphlets, and other anarchist awesomeness at littleblackcart.com, news and up-to-the-minute commentary at anarchistnews.org.